Hi there. Welcome to the Agency Toolkit Podcast, a podcast where we discuss stories, strategies, and techniques to help you build a successful and profitable digital marketing agency. Our episodes contain inspiring conversations with CEOs and entrepreneurs and leave you with actionable tips, ideas, and strategies you can implement into your business today. We are happy to have you with us. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and get inspired.
Hey, Julia here. If you'd like to grow your agency with a new free traffic source, we've put together a free resource for you called the Agency Traffic Blueprint, which outlines how you can acquire free organic traffic for your agency's website using Powered by Marketing. You can get that at getrubyrobin.com/blueprint or check the description of this episode for the link.
Hello, and thank you for tuning into another episode of the Agency Toolkit. I'm your host, Julia McLaughlin. My guest today is Sean Johnson, who is the founder of Forge & Smith, which is a Vancouver-based web agency helping clients launch reimagined web experiences for their audiences for 11 years and counting. So today we're going to be discussing Sean's journey of building his agency and what he's learned along the way. So thank you so much for joining us today, Sean.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So to get started, let's dive into a couple questions so our listeners can get to know you a little bit.
Sure.
So what would you say motivates or inspires you as an entrepreneur?
You know what? It's a good question. At the end of the day, what I really like is collaboration with the people that I work with and our clients. Mm-hmm. The fact that a business came out of it is kind of a happy accident for the most part. It's the collaboration with people, figuring out what their problems are, you know, what potential solutions for, and then helping them through that process to getting what it is that they're looking for. It's that process that I really like. The entrepreneurship behind all of it is you know, people, process, and product. It's how to create a repeatable process that we can take clients through a complicated process in a way that's, you know, hopefully pleasant with a positive outcome. So for me, you know, behind the scenes, it's really the framework that we use to complete our work. Mm-hmm. that I really enjoy. And so I'm a problem solver at heart. So whenever I've got a puzzle in front of me, that's when I'm at my happiest.
Yeah. And I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs who work in digital marketing as well just naturally love to help people. So it's hard to explain what really, you know, fuels that passion, but I agree 100%. I'm the same. It's like, it's so rewarding when you're able to solve that puzzle, both from a creative and a strategic standpoint, when it kind of comes together and you're able to create that magic. And then just, you know, able to just help people. It's so rewarding at the end of the day.
Yeah, it does imbue a certain purpose to the work that we do. So we're not just exchanging time for money. We're putting something out in the world, solving something, even if it's a small thing. So it does make an 8-hour day worth it sometimes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I agree. So how did you get into digital marketing?
You know, that's interesting. It's a story I get asked a lot because it actually relates to the name of the business, Forge & Smith, because there's neither a Forge or a Smith that runs it.
Okay.
I'm actually a career designer. I started professional design in 1996 after I graduated college. But the first 10 or 11 years of my career was production design, production work. I did pre-processing, I did layout design work for a large retailer, amongst other things. So I really didn't start in digital anything because there really wasn't much of a digital thing in the mid-90s. So I had been working for an ad agency when, and I don't know if you remember, when the CSS Garden became sort of this viral thing. So CSS Zen Garden was an experiment by someone based here in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. To show the power of CSS. It was the new sort of styling language. It was supposed to be replacing HTML inline styling. But there was like a war of ideology sort of happening. And I overheard a very heated argument in the office that I was working in. And I was like, what's this CSS stuff? So I dove into it. I taught myself how to program. And through that, I actually really rediscovered a love of craft that I've always had. I grew up around tradespeople my whole life, but you know, in the early 90s, when desktop publishing was becoming a thing, there was this period of time where, you know, smart kids went into computers and dumb kids did trade. I mean, clearly that's not true anymore. It was never true. But when I was a kid, I was just not allowed to go into the trades. And so through building websites, I rediscovered that love of building that I had. And so from there, it just led into naturally the broader digital marketing picture. How do these things that I build engage with people? How does it improve or help conversion? How does it interact with SEO and those types of strategies? And I just got drawn into this whole world of sort of constant learning and iteration and change. That I find really exciting.
That's really cool. So you're completely self-taught then?
Yeah, the you know what the dirty secret for most developers is that a lot of it is self-taught. It's a lot of it's just experimentation and trial and error.
Yeah.
Nobody lets me touch the code anymore. So it's been a little while since I've built anything that way. But yeah, totally self-taught. And self-taught back when Internet Explorer 6 was still a thing and it was a total disaster. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So what really was the deciding factor to start Forge & Smith? Tell us a little bit about, you know, what it was like starting an agency and why you really decided to start that agency.
Yeah. I mean, I went freelance a little later in my career. I already had two kids, so I was in my maybe very late 20s, early 30s, I don't remember exactly. It took some convincing. It felt a little bit risky, convincing my wife at the time was what I'm saying. So, but I was able to build up enough side work to sort of show that it was, you know, I could at least cover what I was making and potentially more. So. My intent had only just to freelance. I wanted to be able to spend more time at home with the kids when they were young. I wanted the flexibility. Mostly, I just wanted control over how I did things. I was tired of other people's processes dictating how I did things. So,
yeah.
So that's where it started. But, you know, one thing led to another and more work sort of kept coming. And so I started adding people to the team. And it got to a point where I had to give them official emails and I just couldn't bring myself to give them seanjohnston.ca email addresses. So I was like, okay, I have to create an agency. And it just sort of had happened organically that way, where it was really just a way to give everybody a name to work under. But then it sort of grew from there over the last 11 years. But that was it. I just wanted to keep doing the freelance thing, but I just needed a larger team to do it with.
It just kept growing. And then you just kind of fell into agency life, it sounds like.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I love it. But it's, I always say starting an agency was the best, worst thing I've ever done.
And then, so where does the name Forge & Smith come from?
Yeah. So it goes back to the trade. So, you know, my father is a Finnish carpenter. So, you know, we grew up with a wood shop in the house. I learned how to use tools when I was young. And I just sort of found myself on around other tradesmen throughout my life. My father-in-law is a general contractor. My stepdad's a master plumber. So just, you know, learning how to use tools and do things yourself. And so I also, probably like a lot of people in tech, a little bit nerdy. And I've read fantasy books since I was a kid. And so there's a lot of like this sort of medieval language. And I really wanted to create something, a name that had building and craftsmanship and identity with either of those things sort of built into it. And you know, the blacksmiths and the old guilds were kind of like a something I always really identified with. So
Yeah,
I was just basically playing around with different names until I could find a domain that nobody else owned, and that's how we landed on Forge. It started as Smith and Forge, but that was taken, so Forge and Smith it was.
Forge and Smith is what you went with. Awesome. That's I love right. that. Interesting. And then, so how do you grow Forge and Smith? You know, how are you bringing leads into your agency and then closing those prospects?
Yeah, growth is, that's been an interesting hurdle. I think like a lot of people, we've grown and shrunk and grown and shrunk a few times until mm-hmm. we figured it out.
Yeah.
You know, we've pivoted services and discontinued things. And, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, we really started focusing on our own code base, our own platform as a way of sort of creating systemization throughout the process so that we can do more with less time to sort of improve our profitability. But in terms of growing the agency, it has been in fits and starts. Lead generation it really came during the freelance time where it was like, I don't have time to go find work. Like when I first started freelancing, I was just trolling Craigslist every morning and bidding on $1,500 websites. That's where we started.
Okay.
I launched my freelance website and ran that for a bunch of years, and then eventually we transitioned to the agency website. But the idea of using what is now just sort of common content marketing, but like in the early 2000s, mid 2000s, the idea of being able to use SEO to bring clients to me mm-hmm. Was really attractive. And so we've always put an enormous amount of effort into that work. So, I would say, in the early days, like 100% of our new work just came through the front door on Google search. Mm-hmm. They weren't always great leads. And back then we were, definitely kind of like in the $5,000 to $8,000 kind of dollar range. But as the sort of the agency reputation grew and as our content marketing efforts got more sophisticated, we started focusing on the client experience. And so when we started really ensuring the client experience was as good as we could make it, then we started seeing a large growth in referrals. So clients referring people to us, our reputation okay. sort of growing in that sense. Particularly in this type of space, marketers move to different companies. We get a lot of return clients, even though they're working for different companies. That happens all the time.
Yep.
Sometimes you get within a network of organizations, like a university. So we have a number of sort of opportunities like that. And as we've continued to sort of exist and survive and thrive, just that general reputation has. You get more direct traffic that way. So it's sort of that layered tier. But at the end of the day, we still publish one blog post a week, four mm-hmm. or five case studies a month, and we still run our content machine as disciplined as we can.
Interesting. So it sounds mm-hmm. like you have leads coming in from a variety of different sources, from SEO to referrals. And
that's right. Yeah. You don't want all your eggs in one basket. You can give yourself as many opportunities to be successful as you can.
Yes. Yeah. So true. Awesome. So what are some, secrets that you've learned along the way for maintaining happy clients who are going to, help bring in those referrals for you down the road?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you're not going to make 100% people, 100% of the people, 100% happy, 100% of the time.
Yeah.
But I think the secret that happy clients is our happy team members and a solid culture. And a secret to both of those things is a very thorough process. People produce product within a process. And so when those things are fully aligned, everybody enjoys their work. And people who enjoy work do better work, and then clients reap the benefits of that better work.
Right. But
then a client also understands what's going to happen, when it's happening, where they are, and what's next, and who they talk to. I mean, when it comes really down to it, what there's kind of a couple of key things that make a happy client. One is being heard. Mm-hmm. One is knowing what to expect. Nobody's happy about sending emails looking for updates and not getting answered. In fact, most clients aren't happy about having to do that in the first place, whether they realize it or not. They yeah. should always know where they are, right? And what's going to happen. As far as the quality of the work, that's sort of the easy part. If you're good at it, the quality is going to be there. But, you know, particularly in the web business, there's a lot of layers to what a website is. We do it all the time. Clients maybe do it every few years, if ever. So to them, it's a very complicated, obscure process. And so when they can see clearly what pieces are going to happen in what order and how mm-hmm. those pieces align with each other, then there's confidence that we're all heading in the right direction. So when they're heard, and when they have their expectations managed, that's the best way to ensure that they are comfortable and they feel safe in the process, and that they know that they have a direct hand in where things are going. That's that other thing, is that you can't allow a client to manage the process for you, because that's how you drive the bus off a cliff. Mm-hmm. But they have to be guiding the process. So, you know, we always talk about our clients being our trusty navigators. So, you know, getting them really involved in helping us understand the business, their culture, their story, their audience, what their needs are, and really shaping everything around those conversations has always been sort of a key ingredient to that. Mm-hmm. Always making sure they don't feel alone. So it's very easy for us to get used to just tossing something over to them, saying, let us know how you think about it or what you think. And then feeling kind of alone and lost in being able to do that. So really making sure that they always know that you're there with them, that you're available, mm-hmm. No matter what. One thing we affirm multiple times throughout the process is you can't hurt our feelings. You cannot offend us. You're never a bother. You're not frustrating us. You're not discouraging us. Mm-hmm. Our only job is to be here to help you through this.
Yeah.
To give you the best possible product, to make sure that this investment you've made, which is sizable, mm-hmm. you're going to reap benefits for the business. That's our only objective. So really making sure that they know and see this throughout the process. And that really is also, you know, at a cultural level, making mm-hmm. sure that every team member knows that this is how we help our clients. This is what our objectives are internally. But the one thing that we're always learning, we're always making small tweaks to our process. Every time there's a project that went not as well as we wanted, like, where did it break down? Where was the wrinkle? What can we do to
yes,
make sure that
so
never
important.
Happens again? Yeah. And so we found as well, you know, the 80-20 rule, 80% of the work's in the final 20%. So that last QA process, while it feels kind of like the end of the runway for us, that's when things start getting very real for the client. So again, making sure that that they're supported and that they're not finding things that we should be finding. So really making sure that you take your QA and testing part of the process really seriously. Mm-hmm. I always tell the team, clients don't only remember how projects end, they don't remember how they start. So that last 20% is really key for them to walk away both excited about the final product, because a lot of them have stakeholders they have to show this to, and they're going to be judged mm-hmm. Or held accountable to that final product. And these are people with their own career objectives and their own goals and their own personal feelings about things. So making sure that they have something they're proud and excited about, mm-hmm. But they felt us consistently being by their side the entire way. So, you know, it sounds simple, but you really have to bake all of that microcosmically all the way through that process.
Yeah.
So there's multiple touch points. There's points where you reaffirm what everybody should already know and sort of continue to sort of maintain that level of attention throughout the process.
Yeah.
And when clients get challenging or confused or difficult, it's really easy to like not give them that same level of attention, but you just have to there's always going to be people with challenges. It's our job to help them through that challenge is what they're paying us for.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys really take that ownership whenever you have a client who might be confused, and you take that, you know, we mentality, like we're working together as a team. We're going to help, you know, you understand this and get back on track.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's, and it does come down to people. So like, I'm not the only person that talks to a client. So the team has to understand what the assignment is, what the mission is, what we believe in culturally as a company. And so we also found over the years that, because people come and people go, it's a natural part of business as people grow. I mean, we're, you know, particularly with developers, you know, what we do from a development perspective is, you know, sort of the same thing a lot. And so they want to move on to like JavaScript jobs and other things like that. So when you have people coming and going, if you don't have that culture documented, if it's not something that you can teach someone, you can't assume it's obvious. Because it isn't. And so when people's values or understandings of how we do things or what our approaches are not firm, then those little interactions that they have with our clients kind of will sometimes represent that. So maybe a flash of frustration comes out, or maybe a little bit of an inattention happens, or maybe a little bit of like, that sounds like a you problem. Go figure it out. I've got other things I need to do. So every time those little interactions happen, it starts to impact the client's faith in your ability to help them.
Yeah.
And that's what undermines that relationship. So where you get somebody like sometimes the worst outcome is it's fine. I hate launching fine websites. It's fine. That's not what I want. Like, in some ways, I'd rather you hate it than just to be ho-hum about it. I want you to be excited about it. So there's lots of times too in feedback where clients are like, okay, it's fine. I'm like, I don't want it to be fine. I want it to be awesome. So what can we do to get it to awesome?
Yeah.
So sometimes it's a small thing. Sometimes sometimes they mean awesome, but it's really just also showing, I saw what you said. Here's your opportunity to tell me that it isn't quite what you want.
Yeah, it's showing that you guys are really listening and, you know, wanting to exceed their expectations.
Yeah. And the other thing too, particularly with designers, because I mean, as a career designer, we get attached to the things we create. We do fall in love with our own work sometimes. Mm-hmm. But not everybody likes the same things that you like. And that's 100%. Also part of the job. So you know, it's not your job to like your work. It's your job to get the client excited about your work. And if that means that's purple when you think it should be blue, it's not your call. It's their call. They have to be happy with it. I don't pay you to be happy with your work. We pay you to make the client happy with our work. That's how we all, you know, keep the lights on and keep roofs over our head. So,
Yeah. No, I love that. I think it's so true. And it can be such a challenge to try and get your team to really, well, first of all, to really ingrain that culture into your team so that they're really, every decision they make is coming through that lens of, you know, what is our culture? And how should I be responding appropriately that's in line with our values? So it's a huge challenge, but it sounds like you guys have really invested a ton of time in achieving that, which is cool.
And not, is relatively recent too. It was particularly because we went remote about 5 years ago, and you know, and leading up to that, because our lease was coming to end, and honestly, given what we do, I've always thought the biggest mistake I ever made was signing a 5-year lease. I wasted a lot of money on that. But sort of leading up to this decision to not renew the lease and move to a remote team, you know, a lot of the research and reading I was doing did talk about the need for a higher level of touch, and so that's when we got. So even then, my preparations, things started to get kind of fragmented and loose because you're not in a room together anymore. And so we really had to double down. We actually put ourselves through our own brand strategy process and, you know, sort of got the entire team involved with it. The output of that was a brand culture document. We created our own employee handbook. Right. So just getting really serious about this and really sort of continuing to sort of push the message. But at the end of the day, culture isn't really just what you talk about. It's what you show. So leadership has to show that culture. Like when things get hard, it's easy to just take the easy way out and compromise that culture, that cultural value. So sometimes it is just showing that I'm going to have that hard conversation with the client and I am going to step up and do this thing. So when, you know, leadership has to be ready to show, and then that, just like with the with clients, that fosters belief that this is who we are as a team. And if you can't create that identity that aligned with individuals' beliefs, mm-hmm. we all want to be good people, we all want to be helpful, we all want to do good work, we all want to enjoy our lives. And so, you know, it's not that hard to get everybody on board with things that align with them. Mm-hmm. It's just, again, it takes attention and discipline. And there are moments where you have to recognize I can either show the culture mm-hmm. or I can talk about the culture and show something else. And
yeah. Sort
of all, you know, being aware of when those points are important. Yeah.
Yeah. And employees can see through when, you know, you're not living that what your culture and your values represent as well. And it can definitely be damaging to morale and to your overall culture as well when your actions and your words aren't lining up.
Yeah. I mean, one of the scariest things we've ever done was launch. We use a product for this. It's based in Slack, but we launched maybe 3 years ago now. A way for the team members to give us anonymous feedback.
That's surveys. Such a good idea.
Yeah, and it's scary because mm-hmm. there's stuff in there that hurts your feelings, that makes mm-hmm. you upset, that doesn't align with what you think is happening. So it doesn't really matter what you want to be true. It's what is true that matters. And so, yeah, when we got a first month in there, like, we had some work to do. There were some things I thought were okay that weren't, and there were some things that I thought weren't okay that were. So it really was a process of understanding, you know, what do people value? So for me, I always hated one-on-one reviews. I don't want to talk about my performance. I don't get any value from doing it. I get my affirmation from how clients react to my work. That's the feedback that I need. I get my one-on-one reviews every time I show clients stuff. So I'm a Gen X. That's what it was for us generationally, but millennials and some of the younger team members that are borderline Zoomers, they want to talk about this stuff all the time. They want FaceTime with their managers. They want, so we implemented a process where, you know, we institutionalized and systematized that kind of regular feedback. So we have weekly high fives, we've got goal setting reviews, we've got quarterly one-on-ones. So really making sure there was a ton of opportunity for feedback and connection mm-hmm. so that, you know, we're setting goals, we have skills matrices to sort of measure improvement across different skill sets, give them plenty of opportunity for professional development to increase. And so, you know, that whole process, and even now, like, we have an individual that we know isn't feeling great about things, and we know why, but we can see it in the scores that we're getting where we need to be able to do that work. And while it is scary and it does hurt your feelings sometimes, it is totally necessary. So
yeah.
That's so that really was one of the yeah, and it's what's, and the reason why I'm talking about this is that all of this has continued to improve client happiness. The end result mm-hmm. has only been better engagement, better outcomes, and better client experiences.
So interesting.
Yeah, it's all interconnected. You've got people producing a product through a process.
Yes. And then what software did you guys use to collect that anonymous feedback?
So we're a Slack shop, and everything else is Google. So we use Slack. The product's called Office Vibe.
Okay. Very cool.
Office Vibe. It's not inexpensive. It's not outrageously expensive. It's a sort of a typical per user SaaS. Yeah. But it does an amazing job of automating and anonymizing the pulse surveys and the feedback. Some of it is like, hey guys, like, if you don't do it, I can't help. So, like, you know, just take a moment. I know it's interrupting your flow sometimes, but the reporting on the other side for team members, so team leads can see what their teams are saying. And I can see sort of the overall health of the company, but the reporting is, is really insightful. I think the genius behind Office Vibe is the questions they ask.
Okay.
Right, across a broad range. I mean, there's some things where it's like, okay, fine. Like, we don't talk about, you know, nutrition and how you should be eating. I just don't see that as our job. So yeah. So when they get those questions, they're like, well, no, they don't talk about this. So like, I don't necessarily worry about that.
Yeah.
But I care if you're stressed. I care if you aren't clear about what your role is. I care that you're not getting enough feedback. I care that you're, you know, you don't feel your work has value. Like, these are the things that I care about. What can we do about it? And then just having those discussions and breaking it down and having it stay a constant topic. Again, it makes, just like the clients, it makes the team felt heard. It makes them feel safe. It makes them feel supported. And that's how you foster belief and engagement. I wish I had known that a long time ago.
Yeah. No, it's such a great insight to share. And so Office Vibe, definitely going to check that out.
It's scary, but no one in the long run, you got to be an adult about it. You have to be open-minded about what you're going to hear, and you have to be ready to just deal with the hard questions and the hard problems and have those questions. Mm-hmm. But if you're really serious about agency culture and team satisfaction and how that impacts the business as a whole, I couldn't recommend it more.
Just amazing. Very
just
cool.
Gear up. It's going to be a little unpleasant in the beginning.
Got to have a thick skin.
Some surprises. That's right. Yeah. When it's anonymous, they can be.
They really don't hold back.
That's right.
So where do you see Forge and Smith in 5 years' time?
It's an interesting question. I mean, we're really at the mercy of the market and changing technology. I mean, I think browser technology has plateaued for a while. It's been a long time since some new rendering engine has created problems for us. I think what we've really had to get really practical and realistic about over the last few years is that because of the popularity, you know, not necessarily the power, but the popularity of things like Squarespace, like Wix, in the WordPress world, like Elementor, Divi, you know, our clients now are often, you know, marketing team members or marketing leadership that have used these tools. And so they're like, I should be able to do all these things. And so, you know, the challenge is how do I produce a bespoke website that still provides this level of, I want to move this around here, or I want to make these kinds of changes without having to go through the developer. So those expectations really, really got real for us a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And so that's when we really started a process of doubling down on our own research and development and our own sort of effectively product development. It started as just sort of creating a better, more flexible platform or starter theme, or however we're WordPress shop. So everything we do is in WordPress, mm-hmm. but a better product for them so that we could actually satisfy what was becoming a set of expectations I had no control over. I can't tell a client, you know, for a $20,000 website, you don't get to move this button. It just doesn't work. If they want to move the button, they have to be able to move the button.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we didn't want to resort to using these platforms because philosophically we had a problem with how they render. Like, you know, an Elementor and a Divi give you that kind of control, but they give it to you at the cost of accessibility, of SEO performance, just page speeds, which wasn't something we were willing to sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to sort of like hang our destiny on somebody else's product. So that's, we started is just sort of taking what we had loosely called Anvil internally, which was just sort of our starter theme that we played with, mm-hmm. and really got serious about making it a real thing. And so, and it's been quite successful. And again, it's in the tech space. One of the things I love about it is that it's never static. You're constantly learning. I learn something new all the time. I've got ADHD. That's really important for me. It's how I'm able to stay engaged with doing effectively the same thing over and over again. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that has actually reached a point where where the prediction that I have and have had for years about where this industry is going is the commoditization of web services is a real thing. I don't feel, outside of like, we have $1 million and we don't care what we do with it. But beyond that, within the SMB space in particular, like people are going to say, like, why should I spend $30,000 on a website when I can get it for $50 on Squarespace? Like, I don't get the difference between these two things.
Yeah.
And so this constant downward pressure on what you charge for a bespoke website, as well as sort of this extending pressure of what I should be able to do with this thing that I've spent all this money for, you know, it's just going to kind of continue to push us in this direction. And so, you know, I've always, there's a story that I tell all the time. It's back from my pre-processing days. So before PDFs existed, when you did print design, that those designs were sent to a pre-processing shop. And what they actually did is they broke it into film, CMYK, and then that was sort of like this whole burning printing process. It was a whole industry just based on doing this pre-processing work. But the PDF technology baked all of that in, and it allowed what was called direct press printing. So the sign shops or print shops that invested in direct to printing printers survived, and the ones that didn't died. But overnight, an entire job description disappeared. And I saw this happen. I knew people that all lost their jobs. These are pre-processed people that have been doing this kind of work for 20 years, just disappeared overnight.
Wow.
Right? Because of technology. So for me, it was always, I've always taken that as a really strong life lesson, that if you're not constantly innovating and paying attention to what's going on, where technology is going, so you can constantly stay a few steps ahead, you're going to be the next pre-processors. So for us, over the next 5 years, like, we're in the midst of transitioning our previous build system, which was an ACF or Advanced Custom Field based Gutenberg system that we still call Anvil. We've actually spent the last year building out our own custom React plugin for Gutenberg that we call Foundry, sticking with the theme.
Yeah, very cool.
But this actually is, I mean, we're still in the early transition. We've got some work to do, but we figure by early 2023 at the latest, it is effectively going to be a no-code WordPress site builder that would be fluid enough to be able to take in any design someone could come up with for a website within proper accessibility requirements and SEO performance.
So cool.
But actually be able to render it without touching code, somewhat eliminating the need for extensive front end development from our process. Where we see this is, you know, it is going to fundamentally change the way that we do our work behind doors. It's going to give us a way to do our prototyping and our design in browser in fluid mockups, rather than the still sort of somewhat archaic static way of doing things, and effectively build the website while doing this. So totally changing how we're kind of walking through the same process with a different tool set. What we're also excited about is being able to license this and market it to other agencies
that currently
outsource their development or don't offer web services and turn work down because they've tried it before and they've got burned or whatever.
Yeah.
But be able to license this and sell effectively our process and our understanding to agencies to really help them sell websites to their clients in a way that doesn't require them to know how to code, doesn't require them to know how to sort of manage a technical process, and won't require them to need to support clients forever. Because, you know, anyone that's launched a website knows that they're going to be married to that for the next 3 years. So every time a client has a problem, it's your problem. So taking that angst away by baking in maintenance and training and client support directly. So all they really need to do is focus on building and selling that website. So we're right in the middle of that transition right now. And so, you know, that, and it's been something we've been working towards for the last 3 years. So in the next
exciting.
5 years, yeah, I'd like to see us fully transition to a product-based platform offering what we're doing. Forge & Smith will always offer custom websites on this platform, but yeah, actually making the shift from a service-based business that has a quiet product in the background to a product-based business that offers services. That's where we see ourselves.
It's where I love that.
That's going. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. And are you guys going to be doing like a beta testing at some point?
I've been doing it since Monday, so I'm actually taking a live project and building it out myself.
Okay.
Right. Because it's got to pass. I'm basically trying to replicate my own or our own design process in a web-based tool.
Okay.
And so the engineers have had their time to build up the guts of it, and they've done an amazing job on it. But now it's like, it's the workflow stuff. Like, I'm a designer. How would I want to be able to do this thing? How can we adjust these settings to make sense to me rather than to a developer? So that mm-hmm. beta processing is happening. We've got one more sprint, then we have one more mobile sprint that should happen in the first half of November. But from then we're transitioning all our builds to it, which will be the last of our own beta testing. So we're going to be our own canaries down the coal mine.
Yeah.
And then, we have some early conversations going. We're hoping to start on-ramping agency clients throughout December and January. Can't really control the economy, so we'll see how that impacts our timelines. But for the most part, we've completed our alphas. We're in the middle of our beta testing right now and should be open for business in the next few months.
That's so cool. So if any agency owners who are listening are interested in just connecting to learn a little bit more about it, what's the best way that they can reach you at?
They can either go through the website or just email me directly at sean@forgeandsmith.com. Yep.
Awesome. Very cool. All right. Well, we are now getting ready to move on to the fast five. So I have five rapid fire questions.
I'm ready.
All right. So what's a book you've read that's made an impact on you?
The book that's had the largest impact, you can see my library behind me, is a book by Michael Michalowicz. I don't know if I'm saying that properly, called Profit First. Any agency owner who has not read Profit First should stop by that book and read it right now. It completely changed my understanding of what an agency financial model should be. So the idea is overhead minus profit equals, sorry, revenue minus profit equals overhead, not the other way around. So Profit First, life-changing book.
Amazing. And what does your morning routine look like?
Again, ADHD is very important that I have process. I get up at 6 o'clock. I work out. I put away the dishes. I know that sounds silly, but it's part of my home taking. I eat breakfast. I come out to work with my coffee. Drink my coffee while I clean up my inbox. I use a tool that allows me to sort of take anything I need to deal with today or tomorrow and task those out. So my whole job is just to curate the inbox, take care of the team needs that have popped up in Slack, because I tend to start later than most people. Mm-hmm. I work through my tasks, and then my afternoon is set aside for production.
Awesome. Sounds like a great routine.
Mm-hmm.
And is there a CEO that you follow or study?
Well, I mean, it might be a little bit generic, but I've always been pretty inspired by Steve Jobs, which I've got a number of posters in front of me, one of which I made myself with his crazy one speech. It's just the idea of having a vision and sticking with it, no matter how odd it may seem or radical it may seem to others. And so for me, that's always been, you know, I've had a strong idea of how this process should work, and I haven't always immediately had people believe that that's the way it could or should work. And so just, you know, believing in the vision and doing what you need to sort of bring it to fruition, even when it doesn't work the way you want.
Yeah, that's
I've always drawn a lot of inspiration from his example and his words, just for my own vision pursuance. Yeah,
that's always a great reminder because, yeah, you get tough times as an entrepreneur. So, yeah, when you can get that inspiration to just, you know, keep going, keep persisting through the hard times, it's always important.
Mm-hmm.
And what is your favorite online tool?
It's actually hard. I always tell my kids I don't do favorites. The latest tool that I'm quite obsessed with is Figma. If there's anyone that hasn't shifted their design process to Figma, you need to really give it a look. It is by far and away the most web-centric design tool that's really ever been invented. Plus the opportunities it creates for collaboration are like being able to work together at the same time on a design document is like, it's pretty cool. It's pretty life-changing. Office Vibe, it's hard not to overstate the value of that. Mm-hmm. But I think that if I had to pick a favorite, it's this silly Chrome extension. Not silly, it's a really great tool, but it's just this little Chrome extension called Active Inbox. Mm-hmm. So basically what it does is it gives me a task panel at the top of my inbox in Gmail. Mm-hmm. And it allows me to set a date as a task. So it allows me to take any email and basically turn it into a task with a date assigned to it. So it allows me to triage what's in my inbox because I'm obsessed with inbox zero. Mm-hmm. It allows me to automate in a very easy way my follow-up process, which is critical from a sales perspective. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of helps me with follow-up. So like if I see a client message comes through and I want to resist the urge to answer the question for a team member, but I want to make sure that it gets answered, I can set it as a task tomorrow so I don't forget. And again, with ADHD, I get pretty focused and it's easy for me to forget stuff. So Active Inbox, if I had to pick one, is it.
Awesome. Those are three really great recommendations. And last question, what's one thing you wish you had known when you began your career?
Yeah, that's, you know what, it's a personal thing. I grew up a little hard, and you know, in the 90s, they didn't have a name for ADHD. So it's, it wasn't always easy. So, one of the things, again, I don't know how many people struggle with ADHD. It's very prevalent in the entrepreneur space. I'm sure mm-hmm. you already know.
Yep.
I wish what I had known before I started was that the worst case scenario, the worst case scenario you can imagine never comes to pass.
Mm-hmm.
The best case scenario that you can pour all your dreams into will never come to pass. What it most often happens is something in the middle. And I wish if I had known that having a plan and sticking to that plan for a reasonable amount of time isn't an obstruction to my vision or my dreams, that it was the best way to achieve them. So that, you know, on a bad day, I didn't fall down the rabbit hole of fear. And on a good day, I didn't mortgage my future by believing in some idealistic thing that was probably never going to happen. If I had known that the middle is most often where things happen with a lot less oscillating between polar opposites, I would have saved myself a lot of stress and a lot of sleepless nights.
Yeah. And I love what you say there about having that plan, because it can feel mundane when you're doing that, those same tasks, but you know, as long as they are moving the needle, that's a really great place to be in when you get to that point where you're doing the same thing over and over and the company is growing because of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a good point.
That's There was also a book that I read. My son was diagnosed with ADHD when I was in my early 30s. I'm 46 now. Mm-hmm. I read a book called Adult ADHD, How to Survive as a Hunter in a Farmer's World. The whole book itself, I didn't really read the whole thing, but there was one section in that book about entrepreneurship. And one thing that one thing I wish I had known in the beginning is at some point, your strengths as a hunter within a new entrepreneurial venture, eventually that company matures to a point where those strengths become weaknesses. You start to harm the business. And so it's important to bring on partners that can help transition to farming. And while that sounds maybe a little agrarian, the best thing I ever did, I wish I had known how helpful that would have been. I didn't give away control. I tempered my impulses in a way that made us all more successful. So again, I wish I had brought partners or not, it doesn't have to be like real partners, but just people you empower to help you make decisions. Mm-hmm. In like a contractual way, like, you know, because in the height of fear and the height of hopefulness, it's easy to override somebody's advice because you're really focused on one of those two things. So it has to be a meaningful empowerment. And so, you know, when I brought on, you know, our operation director, Troy, and a friend of mine as a business development, Ryan, when I empowered those two to help me make decisions, I knew that I would have to like justify what I wanted to do to people. And if I knew that was never going to pass, then that it helped me learn what was real and what wasn't. And if I had done that earlier, I probably would have made my life a lot easier. I would have made the business successful faster. And I probably would have impacted people consistently more positively than I had in some of the early days when I was flailing around trying to figure it out on my own.
Yeah. It's really interesting because, yeah, you got to analyze, you know, where your strengths lie and then, you know, put those measures into place of how you're going to create the best path to work forward from there.
Yeah. There's things I'm really good at and there's things I'm really bad at. Yeah. And being honest about that with yourself, I think is really important for anybody.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Sean. It was a real pleasure to have you on today's episode. I really enjoyed learning about your story and your challenges and experiences with growing your agency. So thank you again for joining me for today's episode.
Well, thank you again. It was just it's fun to talk shop. I don't always get a chance at this level to talk about running an agency. So I really enjoyed it as well. Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Agency Toolkit. We hope you've learned something new that you can implement into your agency today. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to our podcast, and we'll see you next time.